If you have your Bibles, I'd invite you with me to turn to Psalm 91. For the second week in a row, we're going to divert from the message that you have printed in your bulletin that we're kind of leaning towards in our series on Acts. I don't think this is going to be a habit, but it sure felt important that we would spend some time talking about biblical perspective to things that so many of us are thinking about. I'm amazed by the way that God designed humans to handle dangerous situations. We have a built-in radar that alerts us to the presence of danger or of enemies. You know what I'm talking about? Faith and I spent the first 7 years of our marriage in living in a very rough section of North Minneapolis in Minnesota. In our neighborhood where we live, there were lots of gangs, lots of violence, lots of shootings. I mean, pretty common in our area to hear gunshots in the night and sirens and all kinds of things happening in this area that we could afford to live in. And there were many occasions during those years when you didn't know why, but you knew that something was wrong, something wasn't right. We came home one night from going out to eat with a couple of friends, and when we opened our front door and walked in, immediately I knew that something wasn't right. I couldn't necessarily identify it, but I could tell you that when we opened the door and walked in, my senses were on high alert. And it took a little bit of time, not long, a sort of walk through to the house, the little duplex that we're renting, to find out that our back door had been pried open and somebody had been in the house. Our TV was gone. A couple other things were gone. I didn't notice them specifically when we walked in, but my subconscious, that's what I think, my subconscious did, and I knew immediately that something wasn't right. And then, of course, you're wondering, are people still in the house? And they weren't, but you have this danger sensor that goes off. I remember pretty vividly the night my sister, Amy, was living with us and working in Minneapolis, and she came home a little bit later in the evening. It wasn't late at night, but it was dark out, and she got out of her car. I was in the house sitting on our couch. The doors were closed. The windows were closed, and as I'm sitting there, and there's lots of noises in our neighborhood. I mean, constant noise in our neighborhood. But I was sitting there, and I knew something happened. I couldn't necessarily identify it, but in really an instant, I shot up from where I was sitting, and I ran out the door, and I ran down our porch, and I opened our porch door, and I ran down the steps, and outside of our gate of our yard, and about 20 yards to where my sister had gotten out of her car, and in the 20 yards from our car to our house, somebody had come by and knocked her over and stole her purse and was running off. And I got there, I mean, when he wasn't very far off. In fact, I chased him down the road a little bit and then came back to see if my sister was okay. I maybe should have done it the other way around. And the thing is, she said, "How did you get here? I didn't scream. There wasn't a lot of noise. But I heard something, and my brain registered that it wasn't usual." And in that instance, you know, we have this sense, this radar, this enemy detector that immediately, you know, you flood with adrenaline from, you know, the lazy state that I was in to immediately you're awake and you're going because you know something's happening. Many, many times during those years, you know, you're walking down the street and you couldn't necessarily see anything going on, but you knew, you know, I walked down this street yesterday or the day before and everything seemed fine, but now walking down this street, something seems off. You just have this sense and you kind of go on high alert. I'm guessing everybody has these experiences. We're told that we really only use a very small percentage of our brain capacity. In fact, some of us use even a little smaller percentage of that capacity. But that we have, I mean, they really, we're told, a danger sensor in our subconscious. It's not that we have ESP, right? It's not that we can tell kind of extra sensory perception, but our subconscious mind actually picks up subtle changes. We don't process them normally except in danger. And then in danger, your subconscious mind triggers something. I walked in that house and my mind saw that there were pieces missing. Even though my brain didn't register it, the TV was gone, there's other things that were gone. My brain said something was wrong even before I knew that the back door had been broken into. Some sort of noise my brain subconsciously triggered when my sister was walking from her car and we reacted to that. I didn't necessarily know what it was, but we have this enemy sensor, this danger sensor. Some of you are not old enough to remember 9/11, but a lot of us in here do. September 11th, 2001. I was in my car on a Tuesday morning in Minnesota, September 11th, and I heard in my car just a very sketchy report of the fact that, you know, at that time a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center and President Bush was on his way to Air Force One, and I'm telling you, my danger sensor, my enemy sensor went off, and it went off loud, and many other people experienced that same thing, and it got louder as the day progressed and as the news reports started rolling in. You know, over the last month, we all have had a cascading onslaught of coronavirus information coming at us. I told you earlier about my flight to Tokyo. That was sort of the first trigger of that for me. But that info has come at us in waves, especially in the last week. We've, you know, had more and more information. It really does feel like this cascading, overwhelming sense of information that's coming at us. It's something that we've never dealt with before. I mean, it's new for everybody. And you're not sure who to trust. There's different voices saying different things. Bill Gates, this is about a week ago, expressed that the COVID-19 may be the once-in-a-century pathogen we've been worried about. At the same time, a week or so ago, Elon Musk tweeted, the coronavirus panic is dumb. So both Bill Gates and Elon Musk are brilliant, extremely hardworking, accomplished business leaders. And the truth is that very smart people can disagree about very important issues. And we have a lot of information coming at us from all different perspectives. And even now, today, we don't really know what's going to happen. I mean, there's some, if you listen to certain places, there's some very dire forecasts. And then at the same time, there's some descriptions that maybe when this is all over, we're going to have this idea that it was a big overreaction. I don't know. In fact, you don't know. You might have a strong opinion about it. I mean, many people do. So we might have some opinions about it. But we have all of these things that are coming at us, and you start to feel overwhelmed. There's a real uncertainty that sort of has a tendency to kind of well up in our hearts and in our spirits, and we experience and feel things like fear and panic and anxiety and worry. It's uncertainty. I mean, I that's the word that I think I'd like to use to describe where we're at. I mean, you might feel like you have some certainty, but a lot of us are just, you're just not sure. You don't know who to listen to, and that can create other types of emotions and responses for us. I imagine that most of us aren't really sure how we're supposed to respond, how we're supposed to deal with all this new data, all these opinions. I think the scriptures give us some real help here. And I already mentioned, I want to take a look at Psalm 91. The Psalms are really filled with encouraging things about how to deal with uncertainty, how to deal with danger. Already in this service, we've talked about Psalm 46, Psalm 121. We read from Isaiah 43. At the end of this time, we're going to say, run to the Scriptures. So there's lots of places. But I think that Psalm 91 has a very special message for us this morning. And I really think that unlike few other Bible passages, Psalm 91 comes to grips with fear and an uncertainty and unknown enemy attacks and gives us real hope about how to get beyond them. And so I want to read this text. We're going to read all 16 verses, and then we're going to try to overview and summarize the key parts of the different sections. I'm praying that this would be helpful for you, for us, as we navigate these days. Psalm 91 and verse 1 says, "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence." I'm going to stop in our reading, not many places, but at each spot where we have sort of similar kinds of words that I think is the reason why we're pointed to this text this morning. Noisome has the idea of deadly, and pestilence is this idea of deadly, specifically dreaded diseases, plagues, epidemics. That's all a part of the definition of this word. And I think what it tells us is that we're not the first people to have experienced something like this. I think this text is talking about the experiences that they had in the Old Testament times. And all we have to do is look at history. In fact, there's lots of people groups that experience epidemics like this annually. They keep coming around. So we're not the first people to have experienced this, and I think the Scripture gives us some help. Verse 4, "He shall cover thee with His feathers, and under His wings shalt thou trust." Really key phrase, "His truth shall be thy shield and buckler." Verses 5 through 7, I'm going to read them here in a minute, but there might be some reference. I want to give you a picture before we read it. There might be some reference to them to some warfare. But there's very specific reference, I think, to disease and pestilence, and there's a few words that describe this. "Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee." And the point really is that there is no need for us to fear or worry about the arrow. I mean, this is the description, about the arrow of disease, whether it comes in the middle of the night or whether it comes stalking in the dreaded part of the day. I think it's very clear talking about it. There's no need to fear this. There's some reasons. Verse 8. "Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee, to keep thee in all thy ways. And they shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. Thou shalt tread upon the lion and the adder, the young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. Because he hath set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high, because he hath known my name. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation." All right, so this is a loaded text. And here's the question that I think this text answers. I think it's so appropriate for us in March 2020. How do we respond in these uncertain times? Before we go too far along, I want to make one thing very clear, and that is that Psalm 91 doesn't provide us a blanket promise. I want to talk about what it does, but I want to tell you first that it doesn't provide a blanket promise. It's clearly a very specific set of promises for specific individuals. Here's who it's talking to. Verse 1, those who dwell in the secret place of the Most High. We'll try to define this, but it's this idea of those who habitually abide and dwell in the presence of God. It's talking to, verse 9, those who have made the Lord their habitation. And it's talking to verse 14, those who have set their love upon God. All right, so we have a very specific audience that these promises are made to. And we'll talk about these verses as we go. But it really is this idea, for those who are habitually abiding in the presence of God, I think we see three very assuring promises that help us respond properly when we find ourselves in the middle of great uncertainty and very real threats. And here's the three things I think we see. Number one is this. We can find protection in the middle of danger. Verses 1 through 4 talk about this, then we're going to jump down to verses 11 through 13. It's very important that we remember something that these verses clearly teach. And that is that believers are not removed from the presence of danger. God has planned that we would continue to live in the world, and he's planned that as long as we're in the world, we are going to face dangerous situations. There's no way to isolate yourself from every hint of danger. Parents, you can protect your children, but you'll never be able to shelter your kids from every risk. And this scripture is for sure not teaching us that. God deliberately did not remove us from this atmosphere of hostility. He promises that all the while, he's going to be with us. He promises his protection. We'll talk about what that means. So let's ask two questions about these first few verses. Number one, who will be protected? And then I want to talk about how will they be protected. Verses 1 and 2, who will be protected? The secret, of course, is in verse 1, those who dwell in the secret place or the shelter of the Most High. We're going to have to tell you about some words. This is a very word-rich text, and so we'll have to make some definitions as we go through it. It helps to explain and bring color to what Psalmist is talking about. But this word dwells, right away in verse 1, is the idea of to remain or to sit or abide, and it has the idea of permanence. If you can kind of put that in your brain, this to dwell is the idea of permanence. We would say something like that we are to live in conscious fellowship with, we are to draw daily strength from, we are to let him habitually have first place. All of these things are what it's talking about, that he who dwells, and then it talks about in the secret place. And this idea, I think, further develops the mention of his secret place. It has the idea of a cove or a covert secret hideaway. It really is this idea. It was a secret location for the king, for an authority that could be tucked away and protected from the enemies. That's what this dwelling in the secret place, but we're talking about the secret place of the Most High, of the Almighty. There's another interesting word. We're told that as this type of close fellowship is maintained, we will abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I said that the word dwell has the idea of a permanent abiding. The word abide is more temporary. It's sort of the idea of an overnight stay. You abide at somebody's house overnight. It's a periodic rest or a stopover for lodging. So, I mean, I really love how this goes together. I mean, this is the picture that as we abide together in a permanent way in the secret place of the Most High, then those who are abiding in the secret place of the Most High have the privilege of this overnight stay in the times of danger, in the times of concern. We have this idea of being able to shelter under the shadow of the Almighty. under the shadow has this idea of closeness and protection and care. I mean, it makes sense, right? The shadow, it's sort of tucked right into. It's a picture of intimacy. I mean, you're right within that person, that thing's shadow, just tucked right in the protection. When I was a kid, I grew up in Colorado through fourth grade when our family moved to California. But my dad pastored a church in northern Colorado, and I was born there. We built a house. The church actually was built during that time frame in this area, and then a few years later, we built a house that was sort of on the backside off the property. There's another road that came around, so it's on the road, but on the backside, connected by a field to the church property. My dad's office was on a wing of the church over here, and then the auditorium building was a bigger building that was kind of in this location, and then our house was, you know, up this on the road, kind of kitty corner from here. And so if I was spending time, you know, with my dad, hanging out, you know, with the man in his office, and then I needed to go home, you know, for lunch, or he sent me home, you know, I had a couple of options. I could, you know, go out of his office and out the side, and I could go around the building, and then, you know, up the parking lot, and then over to our house. It would take, you know, a few minutes. But there was a shortcut. And the shortcut was, I just had to go down the hall of that office wing, and then you could cut through the back of the auditorium to a door that went out on the other side into the field and then to our house. The problem with that was the auditorium was dark. I don't know if you, has everybody been in this auditorium when it's dark? Auditoriums are kind of scary places when it's dark, and I didn't like it. I didn't like going through the back of that open space where I couldn't see anything. And so, you know, most of the time I'd go around, but every once in a while I was in a hurry, and I'd come up to that door, and I'd push the door open as far as I could to let the light in, and I'd throw it open, then I'd sprint, you know, across the back of the auditorium, hoping somebody hadn't put out a chair or, you know, something in the middle of my path, to try to get to the outside door before the door closed and the light that I had to kind of see across there had ended. So I didn't like going across the back of that auditorium unless Dad was with me. You know, if Dad was with me and we had to walk from his office to our house, it was no problem. And he'd just come to the door, and I mean, I didn't even think about it then. I'd hold his hand, or maybe I just tuck myself close to the shadow of my dad, and we'd walk across the back of that auditorium. It didn't matter if the lights were on or if they're off. There was no fear. There was no panic, because I was in the shadow of this biggest, baddest guy, you know, that I'd ever known. Nothing could ever happen to me when I was in the shadow of my dad. He protected me. I mean, this is the picture of these verses, the shadow, not just of a human dad, but we can abide under the shadow of the Almighty. How will they be protected? Verses 3 and 4 tell us three things. It tells us that he delivers us. Actually, verses 3 and 4 specifically emphasize in the Hebrew structure on the person. So the idea is that he alone, it's not just the idea of the deliverance, but the idea of who's going to deliver, and he is going to deliver. Our God is, and not anyone else. And it's really this emphasis on the idea that our God is wholly and personally involved in the welfare of his people. It's not just this general idea. I mean, God cares, and he is the one who will deliver us. It tells us, number two, that he covers us under his wings. And it's this idea of like an immense bird that's keeping close watch over its brood. Back in the 19th century, William Cushing put this picture into a song when he wrote, "Under his wings I am safely abiding. Though the night deepens and tempests are wild, still I can trust him. I know he will keep me. He has redeemed me, and I am his child." Under his wings, who from his love can sever? Under his wings, my soul shall abide, safely abide forever. So he shelters us under his wings, and then he shields us. The end of verse 4 talks about this. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Shield is sort of this idea of the larger shield. Sometimes it's even carried by a shield bearer. So it's the long, large shield that goes before us. The buckler is the small, round, kind of handheld shield that may go on the forearm. So his truth will be thy shield and buckler. Look down at verse 11. It tells us that not only does God himself protect us, but he has commissioned and appointed angels to care for us. This is the text. There's a few other verses that indicate to some that this idea of guardian angels. And these angels are on top of things, really. And that's what it says. They help you in the little things and the big things. They help you in the little things. They help you so that you wouldn't even stumble and dash your foot against a stone. And then they help in big things. Talks about a lion and a snake. And in fact, not just any lion and any snake. He talks about this is a young, hungry lion. And the dragon is this idea of a cobra rising up. I mean, so it's not just a lion and a snake. These are fierce opponents that would come before us, fierce dangers. You say, well, I mean, if this protection is true, then why do bad things happen to righteous people? I mean, if God is personally involved in his protection for us, and if he's promised that he was going to allow these angels to watch over us so much so that in the little things and the big things that you wouldn't even stumble your toe against a rock and have it your foot gash, and he's going to allow you not to be succumbed to a lion and adder, but you know, I've experienced those things. I've stumbled. I've cut my foot against a rock. I have faced some lions in my life. I've faced some snakes. Some things that seemed overwhelming to me and attacked. And you have too, right? I mean, remember Job? Job 1 tells us that this guy was perfect and upright, a man who hated evil, and he turned from evil. Yet Job's life was filled with a lot of hard things. Where were Job's angels? Where were Job's angels when all of his possessions, I mean, he was a wealthy man, when it was all taken away? Where were Job's angels when he lost his family, his entire family passed away? And when the sickness attacked him in a deathly grip? So what about that? I mean, if this protection is true, then why do these things happen? And what about those believers today who've contracted the virus? Some have died. I looked this morning at, I think it was about 5:30, so I'm sure the numbers have changed already, but the current then, and this, I know in the magnitude of the world, it's maybe not that big, but the numbers then were, you know, about 155,000 cases of known coronavirus, 5,814 people that were reported to have died. There's probably some Christians in there. I mean, how do we read passages like this that talk about protection when we know that bad things do still happen to good people? Let me tell you what I think this means. It's clear that God permits things, in fact, sometimes some terrible things to happen to his children. Job's a great example of this. I've experienced this. You have. You had some bad things that have happened to you. I think the difference is that God's people and God's children know something. We're going to talk about this as we close this out, but God's children know that no power is out of God's control. They learn how to rest and to trust, verse 2 tells us, with this great confidence in knowing that whatever happens on this earth is part of God's knowledge. Nothing happens outside of God's will. So when all this is happening, when the announcements are coming to your phone or whatever your source of information is coming, they're happening one after another, and they just seem to be cascading down. When all this is happening, God was not surprised. He's not up in heaven saying, man, how did that happen? I thought I had that thing contained, and it's just like kind of going crazy now. What am I going to do? God's not saying that. Psalm 46 tells us that through all of these tragedies that God's name will be exalted. And that really leads us to this second promise that helps us respond properly and I think understand what's happening. And that's this: when we find ourselves in the middle of these uncertainties, number two, we can experience peace in the middle of chaos. Verses 5 through 10, I think, talk about this. If you look over the terms that describe the uncertainty, that are very sobering. I mean, it talks about terror in verse 5 and these arrows in verse 5. It talks about pestilence in verse 6 and destruction. It talks about these assaults taking place any time of the day or night. Sometimes we can see them coming, and that's very fearful. And sometimes when we don't see them coming, and that's overwhelming too. And in fact, verse 7 talks about thousands and even tens of thousands of people dying around us. But here's, I think, the key to the whole passage. It's found in verse 4. In fact, if you mark in your Bible, I'd encourage you to circle it or star this phrase or somehow make sure that you know this is kind of the hinge of this text. And it says this: His truth will be your shield and your buckler. I said earlier, as we kind of began this thing, everyone has a danger sensor. Some of our danger sensors are hypersensitive, maybe even oversensitive, and you might find yourself in that kind of a situation. And if your danger sensor is oversensitive, this is the key. This is the help. It's for all of us. And the idea is truth. In fact, his truth. When we think on truth about the situation, you can't buy the over-sensationalized reports. You have to find truth. And sometimes that's hard, but you've got to find truth in this situation. But I'd say even more than that part of it, but the truth about God, about his protection, about his angels. These are the things that give us the ability to go through life facing the uncertainties of life, because it's about his truth. His truth will be and can be your shield and your buckler. That's why verse 5 says, the one who dwells with God has no need to be afraid. They will see the destruction, verse 8. They'll see the consequences of wickedness. But verse 9, because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. Listen, these are life-changing applications of this principle that I hope that you'll grab onto this morning. Please understand, when the going gets rough, whether turmoil in our country or turmoil all around the world, or whether in your own personal life when there's just uncertainty and turmoil happening, nothing else can hold us together and nothing else can keep us from panic like the trust from knowing that and the knowledge that God is there. And second, we have to learn to go to the Word. We go to the place where there's security and hope and help. So we can experience peace in the middle of the chaos. And third, we can learn to trust in the middle of trouble, verses 14 through 16. And in these verses, man, we have these great words like protection and peace and trust. Verses 14 through 16 are really interesting. The speaker changes. You can kind of notice that in the grammar. Before, the speaker is the psalmist. When he's talking about God, the writer says he. You'll see that all through the first part, verses 2 and 3, talks about he. But in verse 14, it changes. God is the speaker. It's first person. And he's saying, I will. We find six I wills in verses 14 through 16. Six promises. He says, I will deliver him. I will set him on high. I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him, and I will satisfy him. What an incredible list of promises. Child of God, these are addressed to you. And just as we kind of wrap this thing up, I want you to look at the first phrase and the last phrase of verse 14. It's the favorite thing of my whole study right here. He says, because he has loved me, and then because he has known my name. The Hebrew term for love is unusual. I don't know that I've looked at it in this way before. Most often, this word refers to attaching something to something. In fact, some of the examples that you give grammatically in the Hebrew dictionary, it's like attaching a saddle to a horse. All right. So the same word translated love here means attaching something to something. And that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, that is really what love means. When we love someone, it's this idea of wanting or desiring to be attached to them. It has the definitions of clinging to, wrapping your arms around this thing. So maybe we could translate verse 14, and I love this, this is God talking to his people, because he clings affectionately to me. Because he loves me. Because he desires to cling, to be close to settle in, to abide in the shadow. Because he clings affectionately to me. These promises, unfortunately, are not for everybody. They weren't meant to be. But God gives these promises to dwellers, to abiders, to clingers. Believers who wrap themselves around their God. Listen, when your world seems so uncertain, whether we're talking about the coronavirus and this situation that we're running in, or whether we're talking about any other situation that you're feeling, when your world seems so uncertain and you don't know what to do and you're unsure of what the next step is, what the Bible says is come and cling to him. And for those who cling to him, who love him, who abide, who rest in the shadow of, to these people he will come and protect and guide. You know, the story I told you earlier about walking through the church, let me tell you a couple of things about it. My trust in my Father was based on knowledge. The fact is, he had never failed to protect me. He'd always had my best good in mind. I was completely safe and comfortable because I knew him. I had this picture of the fact that he could and he would protect me. I could walk across the back of that auditorium in the dark with another adult, and I might feel some encouragement. It's still better than walking across alone, but it's not the same as walking with my dad, because I knew him. I trusted him. He had never failed me. I had complete confidence that as long as I tucked myself into the shadow of my father, everything was going to be okay. So my trust was based on knowledge, but I also want you to know that it's not that we were exempt, completely exempt from danger walking across the back of that auditorium. Something still could have happened. I mean, there really may have been a bad guy hiding underneath its pews. I mean, I don't know. There really may have been monsters in the ductwork, like I thought. I mean, it could have happened. I mean, a beam could have fallen down, you know, and hit us in the head while we're walking across. Really, something dangerous could have happened during that time. We weren't. Just because I was with my dad didn't mean that we were exempt from nothing ever happening. But if it did, I knew that I was with him. And he would take care of it. And he would help me. And he would not leave me. The difference was not that I was never going to have something bad happen. The difference was me. If I stayed in the shadow of my dad, then I didn't have to walk in fear. I didn't have to walk around every time. And if something did happen, it was okay, because dad would be right there beside me. This idea helps us to understand a very important verse in 1 John chapter 4. 1 John 4:18 says, "There is no fear in love, for perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love." This is the connection. He who loves, clings to, abides in, dwells in the shadow of. He who loves casts out fear. Next steps for us this morning. Number one, if you've not done so, can I invite you to find your place this morning in the shadow of the Almighty? There might be some here this morning, and you'd say, there's never been a time. I mean, fear's a real issue for me, but I know that I've never put my faith and trust in the Almighty. And this morning, do you have this kind of intimate relationship with God that you would say, I am dwelling in His shadow? Has there ever been a time in your life when you took God at His word and you asked Him to come and take control of your life and enthrone Himself with you? The Bible is clear about this, that there's a greater danger than even the disease of coronavirus, and it describes the disease of sin. And if you've never received God's antidote, God's forgiveness for your sin, if you've never tucked yourself under the shadow of the Almighty, we want to invite you. We want to help you do that. It's going to involve a repentance of sin and a way of repentance of living apart from God, but we want to help you with that this morning. So if you've not done so, come find your place this morning in the shadow of the Almighty. Number two, don't allow fear to rule your life. Overcome fear with trust. Listen, when those pings are coming at you, those notifications, you know, this is shut down and that is out of control and so-and-so has called this emergency, and your heart starts welling up with the panic and the uncertainty and the fear. I mean, what if fear is a real problem for you? I'm sure that there's some that we're talking to this morning, maybe here, maybe not here. You might be listening on the radio. You might be watching the live stream, and maybe part of the reason you're there is just because you have this real panic and this fear in your heart. Can I encourage you a couple of things? Number one, and I wanted to say this carefully, but can I encourage you if you're saying, man, I have this fear, what do? I want to encourage you, don't isolate. Don't misunderstand this. I'm not saying that there may be appropriate precautions that we're going to take in the coming days diminishing the curve. There may be times that we don't gather in large groups. When I'm saying don't isolate, I'm not saying that some decisions that we might have to make about that, but I am telling you this. There is a reason why the Bible calls us really clearly to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. We need togetherness. And it may be in some different forms. It may be, in live stream opportunities. It may be in small groups. I don't know what that looks like, but I do want to say this before we leave here this morning, and I want to say this particularly for some that really feel fear as a big part of your life. Don't isolate from other believers. This is the time when we need each other. We might have to think creatively how to do that, but don't isolate. Isolation has a tendency to kind of overact some of our fears. And then number two, run to the Scriptures to find truth. Run to them. The Psalms are filled with practical help and guidance to help us in times of trouble. And some of them are some that we said here this morning. Can I list them for you here? Instead of fear, find your way to the shelter and in the shadow of the Most High. Instead of falling to panic, remember that God is there with you. And instead of uncertainty, cling affectionately to the one who keeps his promises and answers our cries. So don't allow fear to rule your life. Overcome fear with trust. And the last thing is this. In these uncertain days, let the church of God and we as his ambassadors, let us be a voice for truth and faith and confidence in an uncertain world. This is what God has called us to.